I recently heard a rather tragic story about four pastors who flew down to a conference somewhere, I think in the southern part of the United States, and they were flying back and they were approaching the runway where they were to land, and sadly the pilot misjudged things. He clipped a power line. The airplane essentially was destroyed, and three of the four passengers were killed. Now, in that case, I guess they would attribute it to pilot error. The fellow who survived thought that they were pretty low when approaching that airport, and sure enough, they were too low. And so the pilot made a pretty substantial mistake that cost not only his own life, but the life of two other people who were there. And the guy who survived had serious burns, and it took him quite a long time for him to recover. Well, we all live in a world where people make mistakes. It may not be pilot error that costs somebody his life, but we all make mistakes from time to time, and it may be that due to our own negligence or due to a failure, due to a problem that we didn't foresee, whatever it might be, we might do something that has radical impact on somebody else, even to the point of causing somebody else's life or costing someone else's life. I believe they call that manslaughter. When a person does something like that, they make an error, mistake, they fail to take care of what they should have taken care of, and the result is the death of an individual, an innocent person. Well, that happens today. In fact, it's happened throughout human history. And the Old Testament law addresses that very thing, the idea of what do we do with a manslayer, somebody who killed somebody else through a mistake. Perhaps it was an idea or an issue of negligence where he should have secured something or fixed something or taken care of something, but he failed to do that. And because of his negligence, or perhaps just because of a mistake, the result is that somebody had died. Well, God instructs Moses to do something about that very issue in the passage we're looking at today. And I don't know if it went through your mind as you read it or as it was read here a few moments ago. What do we do with a passage like this? Because it doesn't really seem to have much of an application to us today. This was written, 3,500 years or so ago. And it directly pertains to Israel and the Jews as they enter the Promised Land. But what does that have for us today? And believe me, as I was starting to work through this passage and prepare a message, one of the first things going through my mind is, what does this have to do with us? And as is normal, as I begin to study, I write a few things down. Oh, okay, I can see this. Oh, yeah, I guess I see that. And pretty soon, by the end of about a week or so of study, I have more material than I can bring forth to, if I were to bring forth everything, we'd be here for an hour and a half. As it is, you'll be lucky if we get out of here in about 40 minutes. But there's a lot here, not only the explanation of what's going on, but there are many principles here that we still use today, that we still value today, particularly in the legal system. And as you look at these three things, the cities of refuge, maintaining borders, and witnesses to a crime, what do these three things that we have in the text in our chapter today, what do these things have in common? Well, the common through line in all this is justice. How can we have justice for the manslayer, for property rights or boundary rights and issues, and then for the accused? Is there justice? How do we make sure that there's justice for these different kinds of people or different kinds of issues? As Israel settles in the Promised Land, they must ensure that justice is done for both victims and perpetrators. And so as we go through the passage, I think we'll find some timeless principles, some principles that apply still because we live in the Western civilization. We see these same principles really from the Bible that pertain to our legal system today. We should be very happy, we should be very glad that we live in the kind of system where we have these kinds of legal protections. We could live in Outer Mongolia where I don't suppose they have these kinds of legal protections. And hopefully most of us don't have to deal with the legal system very often. But if we do, we should be glad that we have some of these legal protections. It should be obvious that the basis for law and justice in the Western tradition, and even in our country, the basis for this is the Word of God. There are people today who say, no, our laws should just be based on our own government. But I believe that our laws ought to go back to biblical principles. And here we see biblical principles that really are the basis of our whole judicial system. And we are very fortunate. We should thank the Lord that we have the kind of a judicial system that we have that has these kinds of legal protections for us. And we benefit from these things when we get into the legal difficulties. And not only the legal system, but we can also, I think, make the application of these principles to our own lives. As we go through here, we'll see that these things pertain not only in a legal sense to the wider community, but we can pursue these things in our own lives. We should be pursuing justice in our personal relationships, and we'll see how that pertains to us as well. So let's notice then three justice issues that Moses refers to here. First of all, cities of refuge ensure justice for the manslayer. And as we find out, the manslayer is a person who's guilty of unintentional killing of someone. So first of all, notice the cities themselves. Verses 1 and 2, when the Lord your God has cut off the nations whose land the Lord your God is giving you, and you dispossess them and dwell in their cities and in their houses, you shall separate three cities for yourself in the midst of your land, which the Lord your God is giving you to possess. Prepare roads, divide the territory. And then at the end of verse 3, God is giving you to inherit that any manslayer may flee there. Okay, so first of all, we have these cities that will be set aside when they enter the promised land. Israel is just about ready to enter the promised land, conquer this area, and when they do so, they should select three cities. They'll separate their whole area up into three different sections, designate these three cities, and make sure that there are roads available so that the manslayer can go from where the event happened to these cities of refuge very quickly. We find guidelines for these cities in three places besides here, three other places in the Old Testament as well. It's in Deuteronomy 4, Deuteronomy 19, and Numbers 35, and then Joshua 20 actually lists the cities. Just in case you're wondering, these cities were Kadesh, Shechem, and Hebron. Now, if you read the book of Joshua, you'll find that those are the designated cities. They had already designated three cities on the other side of the Jordan River, and now they're supposed to designate three more when they get into the promised land. What is the purpose? Again, at the end of verse 3, the purpose for these cities, that any manslayer may flee there. The manslayer can go there to find protection from someone who might want to kill him. And who would want to kill him? Well, it'd be the avenger of blood. We'll look at that in a moment. But what is a manslayer according to the definition here? Verse 4, and this is the case of the manslayer who flees there that he may live. Whoever kills his neighbor unintentionally, not having hated him in the time past. Okay, that's the basic definition here of the manslayer, somebody who is responsible for killing somebody else, but it's done unintentionally. It's an accident. He didn't plan it. He didn't hate the guy ahead of time. There was no malice aforethought, as we sometimes say today. He just, through his own negligence or through a pure accident, he was the cause of somebody else's death. And so when that happens, he could flee to this city of refuge. Moses then gives an example of what could happen in verse 5. As when a man goes to the woods with his neighbor to cut timber, and his hand swings a stroke with the axe to cut down the tree, and the head slips from the handle and strikes his neighbor so that he dies, he shall flee to one of these cities and live. Okay, so we understand how that could happen. A guy is chopping wood out in the woods, and the axe head slips off, somehow hits a person, and that leads to the person's death. That was purely unintentional. So the danger then in verse 6 is, lest the avenger of blood, while his anger is hot, pursues the manslayer and overtake him, and because his way is long, and kill him, though he was not deserving of death, since he had not hated the victim in time past. So this avenger of blood might find this guy who is responsible for the death of a loved one, and he then puts him to death. Now, the family of the dead man might not understand that this death was accidental. Notice it says, when his anger is hot. So, you know, human emotion can be very volatile, can be very explosive. And when you believe that the actions of some person, even his negligence, led to the death of your loved one, you might be very angry about that. And so this avenger of blood then might come along and actually kill the person who is responsible for the death of this innocent person. Apparently, what we have here is a state where they don't have a regular police force. you would think that, okay, who takes care of things like this? It would be the police. But we don't find a police force here. Instead, when things like this happen, the family itself was directly responsible to take vengeance in a situation of murder. Well, Moses is saying this is not a situation of murder. The family might not recognize that. They might think of this situation as murder when it's really just an accident. And so Moses is saying there's got to be protections for that. This man should be able to flee to the city of refuge. The avenger of blood was a person from the family, perhaps the nearest male relative, who is responsible to protect the interests of the family members. He would redeem or return to the family something that belonged to it. In fact, this is the same word, goel, that is true of what other kinsman redeemer? Can you think of a kinsman redeemer in the Bible, in the Old Testament? A guy named Boaz. Boaz is called the goel. He's the family member who not only, in this case, would wreak vengeance on a murderer, but he would take care of family issues, family problems. Somebody gets into debt, they sell off a piece of property, the family determines they want to keep that piece of property within the family, so they go and they buy it back, to redeem, to buy back out of bondage, or to fix a problem or something like that. So the avenger of blood in this case is the executioner. He's the person set aside by the family to handle situations like this. And so Moses is concerned about these vengeance killings that could happen. You know, in some places in the world, they still have vengeance killings. I suppose it goes on here even in the United States from time to time. But there are cultures where if something like this happens, the death of an innocent person, well, then that family takes revenge on the family who committed it, and then there might be a revenge against that. And so there might be this series of vengeance killings or honor killings that could happen. And so Moses doesn't want that to happen, so he sets up this thing with the cities of refuge. You're probably familiar with the Hatfields and the McCoys, you know, from legend, how they were constantly fighting each other. Well, Moses didn't want that to happen, and so he prevents it by setting up these cities of refuge. Now, if we wanted to find a full explanation of the cities of refuge, we could go to Numbers 35. You can mark that down or jot it down, as that's the other place that really describes the cities of refuge. And according to that passage, the manslayer then would be protected in the city of refuge for a certain amount of time. He could flee there, he could live there, until, it says, the death of the high priest. So he's protected there for as long as the high priest lives. He has to stay in the city. And if the avenger of blood finds him outside the gates or outside the limits of the city, he could be legally killed. So if he wants to live, he has to go to the city of refuge. He has to stay there. And then when the high priest would die, then that would terminate the case. So the guy could leave then and go back home. So I suppose the fellow who committed this accident would be very hopeful that the high priest would die soon. Otherwise, he'd have to stay there at the city of refuge until, you know, years, it could be, until the death of the high priest. So I don't know if he was praying that that guy would die or what, but if he wanted to retain his life, he had to stay in the city until the high priest died. Then he could go home. Well, there is an exception here, of course. Moses wants to make sure that everybody knows he's not talking about premeditated murder. So notice verse 11. But, in contrast, if anyone hates his neighbor, lies in wait for him, rises against him, and strikes him mortally so that he dies, and he flees to one of these cities, then the elders of his city shall send and bring him from there and deliver him over to the hand of the avenger of blood that he may die. This protection was not to extend to premeditated murderers, those who murder aforethought with malice. Premeditated murder is not covered under this. This person rises up and strikes down a neighbor so that he dies. That, of course, is a good example of first-degree murder. Premeditated homicide. That's what he's talking about here, and that is not to be protected. A guy like that could flee to one of these cities, but the man's hometown would send to that city and say, wait a second, this is not a case of manslaughter. This is not a case of accident. This is a case of premeditated murder. They'd bring the guy back, and then his blood must be shed, because murder is a very heinous crime. Murder is the eradication of someone bearing the image of God. The Bible says we are made in the image of God. The Bible says Genesis 9:6 that a person who sheds man's blood, an innocent man, for no good reason, his blood must be shed by man. So capital punishment is a biblical principle. We find it at the very beginning in Genesis. We find it throughout the whole Mosaic Code. We find it in the New Testament. So it is a timeless principle that premeditated murder should be punished through the taking of that man's blood or his life. Numbers 35:33. So you shall not pollute the land where you are, for blood defiles the land, and no atonement can be made for the land, for the blood that is shed on it, except by the blood of him who shed it. The blood of one who sheds blood in murder in this fashion, his blood should be taken. And so we should pursue capital punishment for those who are guilty of this kind of murder. And we're all aware of a couple of occasions where that happened very recently. And we may have the tendency to show or want to have pity for certain people who, because of their background, because of their parentage, because of their hard life, we might want to say they don't deserve it. They don't deserve capital punishment because of all these other mitigating factors, so-called. But he will go on to say, your eye shall not pity this kind of person because he's guilty for the blood of that innocent person. And that person deserves capital punishment. So they were to deliver such a person over to the avenger of blood. Again, it's not the policeman who steps in here. It's not so much the government who does this. It is the avenger of blood. It is the person who is supposed to maintain and support and care for the family matters. They turn him over to him and he must die. The murderer deserves no pity. He's worthy of death, and so he's to be executed. But the guilt or the innocence of the person would be determined by the elders of the city. As we go down to verse 17, it talks about the judges and the priests who will be in that day. And so they set up a court system here. Moses sets up essentially a group of people who will be responsible to adjudicate or to examine, to look at these things very carefully to determine who's guilty and who's innocent and then have the right punishment for the guilty. And there's always got to be two or three witnesses. You can't convict somebody on the basis of one individual witness. There's got to be two or three. So there will be this judicial system to evaluate each case and determine who is guilty and who is innocent. Notice in verse 13, your eye shall not pity him, as I said. The criminal should get what he deserves. This word pity means to spare or to have compassion. This man should not be spared. Again, it's sad that in our context we have people who are guilty of this very thing, premeditated murder, and they are spared. Perhaps they live in a state where there's no capital punishment. What happens to those people? They end up on death row or in prison for the rest of their life. The taxpayer is responsible to take care of those people for decades, potentially, when in reality these people should face speedy and just vengeance. Justice should be done for them, which would be the taking of their lives. We should not show pity. In fact, in verse 21, at the very end of the verse here, your eye shall not pity. Granted, we tend to want to show compassion for people like this, but here it says don't show that compassion. Certainly don't spare the person from the justice that really is necessary. And so in some cases, the criminal deserves no pity, no compassion, no protection. Criminals should get what they deserve. And notice the goal here when you do that you shall put away the guilt of innocent blood from Israel, that it may go well with you. So really two purposes here in this kind of capital punishment. First of all, to put away the guilt of innocent blood. Remember, God hates the shedding of innocent blood. So stop this kind of crime from happening. Stop it. Don't let it occur. And then to prevent it, to deter it. If Israel wants to remain in the Promised Land and enjoy prosperity there, as it says, that it may go well with you, well, they have to follow this kind of justice system. So the main principle in view here is justice. The innocent person deserves to be protected. Even though he may be guilty of negligence or neglect, if we think about this example that he gives us in verse 5, how could you prevent the axe head from slipping off the axe handle? Well, there are ways of doing that. You could have secured it. You could have been a little bit proactive. And usually when in a case of an accident like this, People come out as critics and say, well, why didn't you do this beforehand? Why didn't you fix this problem before it happened? Why were you not proactive? Why didn't you check that your brakes were going out? Why didn't you check that, you know, whatever it is that caused the accident, why didn't you check that? For the pilot who crashed and cost the life of two other individuals and himself, why didn't he check to see about that power line? Why was he so low coming into that landing strip? So people can do things to prevent accidents from happening, and they are responsible to do so. But he's still innocent. He's not guilty of murder. He didn't have any malice aforethought. He was not trying to kill anybody. This was a pure accident, even though it was negligence, so you could argue that. Still, he didn't intend for this person to die, so he was not intent on killing anyone. It was an accident. So justice demands that the manslayer in these cases be protected. Further, the manslayer does face some consequences for his behavior. He had to go to the city of refuge, and he had to stay there. He was confined in the city of refuge until the death of the high priest. So it was not like going to jail. They didn't really have jails at this time. He did face consequences for his behavior. He has to leave his home, I imagine he could probably take his family with him if he wanted to, but he would have to go then to one of these cities, stay there until the death of the priest. So he was confined in a certain respect. He was not punished like we punish people in jail or in prison, but he did face consequences for his failure, for his accident. But Moses is trying to prevent the shedding of innocent blood. The pagans, the Canaanites, shed a lot of innocent human blood in Canaan land, in the Promised Land. And so Moses is trying to prevent that from happening. On the other hand, the murderer deserved to lose his life. Capital punishment, as I said, is appropriate in many cases, especially premeditated murder. He does not deserve pity. He does not deserve to be spared. He deserves death. The murderer, unlike the manslayer, is not innocent. He did plan. His intent was to take the life of the victim. And so he's guilty of a crime that demands the shedding of his blood. So this arrangement shows that God values human life. We know that all these things have to happen. The innocent has to be protected and the guilty have to be punished because of what? God values human life. And we can apply that to many situations in our life today, not only capital punishment, but even something like abortion. Why are we against that? Every person is made in the image of God, and God values human life. So we know what our moral duties are to protect human life. Human life is not like other kinds of animal life. Human life is different because we bear the image of God. And that's why murder is so heinous and wrong. We must protect innocence and punish the guilty. So that's the first aspect of the first issue of justice that he mentions here. Then he just goes to one verse, verse 14, with another aspect of justice. You shall not remove your neighbor's landmark, which the men of old have set in your inheritance, which you will inherit in the land that the Lord your God is giving you to possess. Now, when we think of a landmark, we often think of a building of some sort. Whenever I was going down to Rockford, Illinois, I knew the turnoff that I could take because there was a restaurant with a clock. The clock restaurant, that's where I turned. That's my landmark. Oftentimes people don't know their directions or the names of the roads, but they know the landmarks. They know how to get from place to place. And so a landmark often is simply a memorable spot. But in this case, the landmark is a border stone. That's what he's talking about here. This might seem like a fairly minor or obscure matter, but the Old Testament mentions this crime several times, about four or five times. This idea of not moving the border stones is mentioned. So that seems to indicate that this is a fairly common problem. People were moving these border stones. And you can imagine, unlike today, they don't have surveyors who were marking these things out, and there's not a plot, and there's not, you know, you can go to the county department and see where your lot is and stuff. They didn't have stuff like that. They just had border stones that marked the territory. So they're going to get into the Promised Land. They're going to receive their allotment, and then each family in the tribe receives a certain allotment of their allotment, their land, and then they can mark those things out with stones, usually. There's lots of stones in the Middle East, and so you could set up these stones on your borders or the corners of your property or whatever. So the problem would be then, the crime associated here would be moving your border stones. at the cost of your neighbor's land. You can imagine if you move your border over to encroach upon your neighbor's land, you're essentially stealing his land. On my property, I have a border marker that the surveyors must have put down years ago. It's a little orange dot about that big. It's right on the ground. And we go by there sometimes and we say, hey, here's our border. Well, if I could probably pull that thing out and move it over a few feet, I think my neighbor would probably recognize that. But if I did that and claimed that bit of property was mine, what am I doing? I'm essentially stealing property. I'm claiming property that is not my own. So that's the crime, or that's the sin that he's talking about here. And again, the issue at hand is justice. We have the right to own property, but it's both immoral and criminal to take property that does not belong to us. In this case, it's land, but in reality, anything. Whatever property somebody might have, we don't have the right to take somebody else's property. The Bible permits private ownership of land and other property. You know, there are political philosophies like communism that says there's no right to personal property. Are you aware of that? That's what communism says. We're going to take away all your personal property. Everything's going to belong to the state, and we will just give you what you need. We'll let you rent out our property. Well, Christianity and before that Judaism taught that everybody has the right to own property, and other people don't have the right to take it away. So this is a very important principle from the Bible. Somebody said, the right to hold property was a cornerstone of Israel's inheritance from the Lord. It is still a primary right of free people on earth, and without it, freedom is greatly limited. We fortunately live in the Western tradition, and we recognize that we have the right to own property. Many of us do own property, and we recognize we have the right to secure that property from somebody else trying to take it away. So Moses is saying, don't move those borders, because everybody has the right to their property, and you don't have the right to take it away. So we must affirm property rights. And then thirdly, requiring adequate evidence ensures justice for the accused. The third justice issue here is, what do you do about these false witnesses, or how do you protect the accused in this situation? Legal justice requires proper evidence. I don't know if you've ever sat on a jury. I've had to sit on a couple. Well, I sat on one jury, and the other one, the case was terminated before I actually had to sit on the jury to hear the arguments. But when you sit on the jury, what are you doing? You're listening to the evidence, and then you come up with a conclusion, guilty or innocent or not guilty. And so there's got to be evidence for this. And so this is what Moses demands. In the Old Testament system, a person claiming something, making a claim about witnessing a crime, well, a person can do that, but you can't convict just on one witness. The Bible says there has to be at least two or three witnesses. A single witness could certainly testify, but the court could not convict the individual based on just that one person. You have to have two or three witnesses. And so note verse 16. If a false witness arises against any man to testify against him of any wrongdoing, then both men in the controversy shall stand before the Lord, before the priests and the judges who serve in those days. So this false witness, the word false is kind of an interesting one here because it literally means malicious. It's not just somebody who's telling a lie. He is wishing to do evil to the other person. Somebody said that the witness in this case is not a mere observer. His intent was to do violence to the accused for some gain that he might receive thereby. So we're all aware that there are certain times when a witness goes into a courtroom and tells a lie, either to get money or to whatever, have something for himself. Maybe somebody promises them a bribe or something like that to give a false witness. So Israel would look at these cases. Verse 17, both of these men in the controversy stand before the Lord, before the priests and the judges. So there's a law system, a court system set up at this point where the priests and the judges are to serve as judging these kinds of cases. And both the accused and the accuser stand before the Lord. These priests and judges represent God. God is there, you might say, as the representatives, through his representatives, the priests and the Levites, and they are to adjudicate. They are to look at these cases and determine guilt and innocence. So standing before the judges amounted to standing before the Lord. Their job is to ensure that justice is to be done in this case. And so the priests and the Levites then were to evaluate the cases and come to a just decision. Notice verse 18. The judges shall make careful inquiry, and indeed, if the witness is a false witness who has testified falsely against his brother, then you shall do to him as he thought to have done to his brother. So you shall put away evil from among you. Okay, so the false witness would be punished with the same punishment that he sought to inflict on this other person. If his witness proves to be false, he would be punished to the degree or in the scope of what he wanted to do to the other person. He's giving a false witness. What do we call that today if you're in a court of law and you tell lies? That's called, I think it's called perjury, isn't it? So a person can't just waltz into a court case, give a false testimony, and leave scot-free. No, if he has given a false witness, he's supposed to be punished with the punishment that he thought to inflict on the other person. So the threat of punishment for false witnesses would be a deterrent to making these kind of false claims. If you knew that there was a possibility that you would receive from the court what you intended to give to that other guy through your false witness, well, that would be a deterrent to making these kind of false claims. So the goal here of the system is at verse 19. Let's see. So you shall put away the evil from among you. Put away evil. And then verse 20, those who remain shall hear and fear, and hereafter they shall not again commit such evil among you. So one goal was to put away the evil. Quit this. Stop this from happening. Stop this criminal behavior. So stop it from happening, and then that's the purification of evil. Evil, to purify evil from the land. And then deter crime. Deter crime. Others would see it and would fear and not commit such evil among you. It would prevent others or deter them from doing the same kind of thing. Swift, honest, and impartial judgment or punishment of crime decreases the number of criminals and deters crime. Now, that seems to be very common sense, to stop the behavior and to deter it from happening in the future. That's a very good thing, and I wish that our nation, I wish that our states would recognize that swift punishment of crime would stop the crime from happening and it would deter others from doing it in the future. And then verse 21 again, your eye shall not pity, life shall be for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. God has already given these same directions. We find that same statement in Exodus and in Leviticus. Here it is in Deuteronomy. So when God says something multiple times, this is a pretty clear commandment here. You perhaps heard of this law, this idea of retaliation, as lex talionis. I don't know if you've heard that or studied it in the past. Lex talionis says, what you did to others should be done to you. Eye for eye, hand for hand, foot for foot, life for life, tooth for tooth. The criminal should suffer in like manner what his crime produced. Now this is not only for the false witness, but for the criminal. Let's say a criminal is found to be guilty of this crime. Well, what he intended to do to others or what he did to others should be done to him. His life should be taken if he took the life of somebody else. If his actions cause the loss of an eye, his eye should be taken. Likewise for the tooth, the hand, and the foot. The criminal should suffer to the same scope or the same extent as what he caused. Now that might seem rather severe, but it would certainly deter crime. And that's, I think, what Moses is trying to do here. Somebody said that heinous crimes call for an equally stern response. We want to ensure that the proper punishment is given to the criminal. But if you look at this as well from another angle, you're also restricting retribution. It's one thing if a guy took your life, okay, life for life, but hand for hand. Let's say the guy only, whatever, destroyed your hand. You can't kill him. He only destroyed your foot. You can't kill him. In some places, you know, somebody hurts you, you're going to kill him. Well, according to this, you can only do up to the extent of what he did to you. If he knocked out your tooth, you can't kill him. All you can do is take the tooth. That's just, or that is fair. And again, we might think, well, that is very barbaric. But at this time, at this point in history, this was the proper thing. This was justice. It ensured this idea, this law, ensured justice for the guilty as well as for the victim. And we find elsewhere, there is a bit of a reduction, because we find in Numbers chapter 35, it appears that a fine could be paid by the guilty person. So you could, in certain cases at least, pay a fine and not have your, you know, your hand or your foot lopped off. If you had the money, I guess you could pay the fine and avoid some of these consequences. Other than murder, a murderer could not escape justice through the payment of a fine. Well, in each of these three instances of crime and punishment, the manslaughter, the moving of a border stone, and the false witness, the issue at hand is justice. God's intention is that the innocent are protected and that the criminals are punished. These legal principles are both biblical and necessary for a just society. We should still value these principles. And I don't know if you picked them up as we went through here, but these are the principles of our legal system. We should be very glad, we are very fortunate that we still, you know, operate under this kind of a legal system. These are the principles. Innocent human life is valuable and worthy of protection. The shedding of innocent blood is both sinful and criminal. So there are some nations that don't believe that. They shed innocent blood all the time. All citizens are under the law. The law pertains to everyone equally. Everyone has access to due process of law. You can't just have somebody making a claim about you. You have access to the courts, and the courts are going to use judicial reasons, you know, to see who is the who's innocent and who's guilty. People have the right to own and secure personal property. Everyone should have the opportunity to defend himself in a court of law. You have the right to face your accuser in court. That's a big thing. Again, the two people in the controversy should stand before the judges. That's exactly what we do in our system today. Punishment should fit the crime, lex talionis. If you're responsible for this, you ought to have that. The punishment ought to be due to the crime or fit the crime. Solid evidence and reliable testimony should be the basis of legal findings, not hearsay or false claims. Again, this is especially true in murder cases. There's got to be adequate witnesses, hopefully eyewitnesses to this crime, and in order to convict somebody, it has to be obvious. It has to be very clear. Those found guilty in a court of law must be punished appropriately. Capital punishment is required for premeditated murder, and some people are simply not worthy of pity. Particularly, again, murderers should not be given any pity, and swift justice purges evil from a society and deters criminal behavior. Well, we know that accidents happens, crime happens. A society works best when it's committed to the rule of law, when the legal system protects the innocent, and when the law punishes guilty criminals. God says here, Moses says to the people, you will flourish, you will prosper in the promised land if you follow this kind of justice system. That's true for that nation, it's true for nations, and it's true for our lives as well, personally. In our own relationships, we should strive to treat people justly. We should see a difference between an accident and intentional evil behavior. We don't steal other people's property. We apply rules equally and without favoritism. We don't act on hearsay or false claims. We try to deter evil behavior. Punishment, when necessary, must fit the crime. People should face the consequences of their actions, and justice should mark our lives and our behavior. Well, I'll finish by just once again referring to verse 18. The judges shall make careful inquiry. And that should mark our lives as well. Whatever the situation, we should follow that example of looking carefully into the matter and applying these timeless principles of justice. Well, let's close in prayer.